the session this morning. Very informative. My name is Jennifer Failer. I'm the acting executive director for the Trinity River Restoration Program. Want to really thank you all for the opportunity to share our program with you today. I'll be introducing Grant Udermuth, who will run through an update of our program and background information and everything. But just real quickly, we are the first river restoration program attempting to fix an entire ecosystem in a river. We're hoping to demonstrate that you can have both a water supply project and a healthy river system on the same river, with a viable fishery and a healthy ecosystem. That's what we're here to demonstrate. What the Trinity River Restoration Program is a record of decision and a variable funding stream. The heart of the program is a group of agencies that come together and work toward this common mission, and it's agencies with differing interests and differing missions, but we all have to find common ground and work together towards achieving the goals of our program. So that's really what the heart of the program is, and including the Regional Water Quality Control Board and the North Coast region in particular. There was a tremendous amount of staff hours that went into completing a programmatic EIR for the program last year. Somewhat unusual to do a programmatic EIR for a restoration program, so we were breaking new ground and really appreciate all the staff time that went in to support us. You guys are the lead agency, and we just really appreciate the partnership there and the work that was done, and it's going to help to streamline our program in the future to get work done more efficiently, more cost effectively. So thank you very much for that, and thanks for the opportunity to come share more about our program today. And let me introduce Grant Udermuth. He's our environmental specialist and works on all of our environmental compliance and permitting and everything. So Grant, I'll give you a good overview today. Okay. Take it away, Grant. You're welcome.
And I've got some handouts. These are just the slides and stuff, so you'll have a copy of them. I've got enough of them with me, so
great.
Thanks for the opportunity to make this presentation today, and thanks especially to Dean Pratt, who has been working with me for a number of years, and to Samantha Olson for your assistance in the master EIR and the getting that done. It's really going to help our program in getting this restoration moving. I think that this program, you know, this update is from the last time we were here was in support of the restoration exemption for restoration projects, or the exemption criteria for restoration. And there's been a bit done since then. But first off, I'll go through just a quick review of the project. Basically, the compelling problem, this is the area where you were yesterday. This is the Reading Creek restoration site, and right down here is the parking lot, and that's the boat launch. So we were down there, and if you notice, the very confined area is not quite so confined. When the dam went in, there was reduction in flow, the vegetation moved in, the berm developed, and in many areas, there you go, so we're right there. And so the river became encroached, and what that really did is it reduced the access to the floodplain for during high flow events for juvenile rearing to find low velocity habitats that fish could grow in. So our program goals and objectives, these are very similar to the water quality control boards in some ways, that the beneficial uses. We're restoring rearing habitat, and our objective is to do this by restoring natural conditions. And these are just the implementation program has been doing projects and increasing the flows in the river. And the science program has been monitoring this over time. The project area is the 40 miles that Jennifer alluded to, and that's the Trinity is the largest tributary to the Klamath, and the water quality in the Trinity is spectacular in comparison. So we've got, and the ownership is primarily, it's probably 75% public land. So we've got a chance. So you guys know how things get a little lengthy when you have a few partners. We have a few partners. A lot of these bring a lot of expertise to the table, but you also probably are familiar with very educated people, with people with advanced degrees in science, and they don't always agree. And they don't always agree on how things are written. And then there's requirements, individual agency requirements from, I have worked personally for the Fish and Wildlife Service, for the BLM, for state wildlife agencies, and they all have their own criteria and you know, ways that they release information or don't release information. And I know that the Water Quality Control Board has been correctly asking for some documentation showing that their help on this EIR is worthwhile, that we're moving forward. And we have an annual report this year. I know Samantha and Dean received it. I have a copy over there. You know, it's a start, and then in the future we're going to have a lot more reports. There are some individual reports at the agencies, and our new science coordinator, Ernie Clark, is really pulling some of that together. And you know, he works for the Fish and Wildlife Service, and the reports are coming. But just to give you an idea, there's 24 agencies on here, including the Water Board as our programmatic CEQA lead. And the BLM, who owns probably the lion's share of the work or the areas that we do work on, so it is better because we work with these folks, but it's also more difficult. So taking through the record of decision, this is what the original EIS put forth, and the record of decision, the restoration program is meant to put the right flows on based on the water year, to upgrade floodplain structures to allow the water to go through, do channel rehab to fix problems that the flow can't fix. The original thinking is that the river could do most of the work. Coarse sediment, when you put in a dam, there's no more gravel moving through. Should be a conveyor belt. We need to add a lot of gravel in perpetuity. Watershed restoration to reduce fines. Adaptive management to fix it and look at what we're doing and do it better. And then, you know, we're a big project. Minimize and mitigate the impacts. You're doing restoration, but there are impacts, and we can do a good job or not at minimizing and mitigating those. So the high water, before the record decision, we only got 340,000 acre feet. This year, this is optimistic. The decision on the water year is typically, you know, by mid-April, and then we come up with we're not tied to these hydrographs either. We're tied to the acre foot allocation, which is over here. So we will be releasing one of those volumes. It's looking more towards the wet volume, but probably not in that hydrograph shape. Okay, so. Well, we'll go forward with that on that. Hopefully it'll go away. Okay, so this. Okay, so the high flows will come in. These were the bridges, or an example of the bridges, in order to release the 11,000 flow or unconstrained rod flows, we need to replace these. It was interesting, 2004, we had a wet year. We were unable to release the typical 8,500 release because the dam or these bridges were still in place. We only released 6,000 maximum before. There was infrastructure, one of the most noticeable was this house. We moved that in 2006, I believe, just before the highest release. Well, there's May 2006 right there, right after we removed that house. We had a 10,200 release that year. There was We spent $1.6 million in removing physical structures from the floodplain, and we've done it in a real innovative way through basically having landowners do the work and we reimburse them. So, getting into what you folks, the Water Board, has been really helpful in, mechanical channel rehabilitation. This is to fix things that perhaps the flows can't, and or the timing for the flows to fix the conditions for fish and natural processes in the river would be unacceptably long. So basically, the record of decision said do 44 bank or construct 44 bank rehab sites and 3 side channels in 6 years. Now do it fast. So 40 miles, do this, and then monitor the results. So you, in order to have the biggest impact, to be able to measure it on the ground through, you know, rotary screw traps, through looking at the and numbers of fish returning, do this very quick. Well, where are we? We're about halfway, and right now we've done 23 sites. We're 50% complete. And we've done 4 5 EIRs now, and this is one of the places where the Water Board was the lead on one of these for the Canyon Creek Suite, and it was very difficult. What happened with, you know, typically we're doing things that aren't allowed under general permits, and we kept running into that under you know, specific 401 permits or 404 permits with the Army Corps. You know, we have potential site specific losses of wetland. We have short-term potential increases in turbidity. We have riparian vegetation removal. The gist of our program is generally to lower the floodplain, as you saw yesterday, and that often requires removal of vegetation. So one of the things that was really difficult was trying to fit these very different projects, these restoration-based projects, with an objective of river restoration into typical permit. So the Water Board has been incredibly helpful in terms of developing this master EIR, which I think has a really good view on what we need to do and has outlined that for the future. So based on our correct identification of where we're going to do the work and how we're going to do it, this work will be very much streamlined in the future, because we already have a general permit for channel rehab with the Water Board and with the North Coast Regional Water Board, and a general permit for gravel injection. So these are the sites. The phase one sites are in green, and the phase two sites are in brown. And yesterday, just to orient you, you were down here in Douglas City. So it's a big reach. The gravel injection sites that we're annually adding gravel at high flows are those yellow dots up there near Lewiston Lake. So over time, we have adaptively managed, we've changed our program quite a bit. Just to capture some of that in pictures, Hucker Flat was done in 2005. This was the original concept, and that we create these open floodplains, and that would create good rearing habitat. And you know, as we kept looking at it, we kept adjusting, and we realized now that the real need for complexity and structure on these, and that largely involves vegetation. So as we moved through 2006, where the Water Board was the lead, the CEQA lead for our EIR, we left some more vegetation. And then Hoadley Gulch in 08, we were adding a bunch more wood and creating a lot more side channels. And in Sawmill, we were creating very large structures and doing forced meanders, moving the river over. So we've really been evolving towards, you know, more habitat. Wood is good, and that's been a large, much bigger focus in our program since we last spoke with you. Another thing is we're doing, when we lower the elevation of these floodplains, we're collecting gravel, or we're sorting that and using all the gravel from site to placing stream either on site as river bars or upstream at the dam in our high flow injection areas. It's cost efficient. It's a smart thing to do. And it lowers that floodplain elevation, so we'll have riparian vegetation growth. From sometimes we're you know, working on tailings piles that, in my mind, as a wildlife person, those tailings just don't offer the great habitat that we need. Then in terms of mitigation, and you know, keeping the river clean, we've gotten a lot better. Where here you see these pumps. We're just pumping and washing these areas before we open to the river. You can see the pump down there. We're pumping all the time up under to the dry land to infiltrate the sediment and keep the pines out of the river. And then you see we're using this aquadam in our last program, and you know, you can see that the fishermen are still fishing.
Yeah, sure.
So just to give you an idea of the magnitude of these projects, the last year was Dean reminded it was a ARA year, the supercharged restoration program. We put a $5,000 project on the ground, which Reading Creek was only $5,000. Oh, a little bit of gravel. So basically, these and the projects in blue were also the ones that the Water Board has been the CEQA lead agency for. So we are really indebted to your support. And in fact, these, I believe, will all be basically, you know, based on the impacts have been adequately analyzed within the scope of the master. So that is right now what we're looking at. We're working on our Wheel Gulch project for this year, and we think that is the case for it, that it's covered by the master. So we've treated 15 miles of edge habitat and spent $12.6 million on construction. Core 7 augmentation. Now, these are the objectives to basically increase the quantity of core sediment stored in the Trinity River to place about 10,000 tons of high flow gravel, or up to 10,000 tons of gravel at high flow annually, and that's based primarily on the type of water year. We realize now that we can't put in the 67,000 tons of gravel that the original record of decision said, just because it's impractical, you know, to mobilize. But we can do a lot each year and meet the goals. To achieve equilibrium within this upper stretch, so the amount that we add is going to move through the reach each year. And then to reduce the average size, we just don't have the flows that move the giant boulders in the old days. So 3-inch diameter mean size is about what we're looking for in the future. And then we're going to be reducing fine sediment in the watersheds. So how much gravel have we added? A lot. 61,480 tons. And then you can see the breakout for the high flow injections, 3,500. This is a big part of our program now, 3,500. And then 46, and this year we're planning on about up to 7,500 tons at a couple sites, at Loudon and at the Weir Hole. So, just want to run you through site, and this is the Reading Creek site before the project. And our design teams, right now we have different design teams, and as I mentioned before, we may not always agree exactly on everything, and you know, there would be good ideas. So the designers, this one was designed actually by Jeff's day job, by the McBain and Trust group, and they, you know, there were some questions about how they thought it would operate, and they have addressed these, and you know, so basically they will come up with a document, the tech memo, and that describes how they expect the site to evolve over time. And they may not always be doing exactly what these other designers would do, but as long as they can address the questions and say, this is how we think it's going to work, and it's reasonable, then they can go forward with that. So there's a lot of work that's supposed to be done by the river here. This is an expansion area, so we expect deposition in this site over time. This is kind of a contraction area. These are some of the bars that we worked, or that you walked yesterday, and you'll see we removed a lot of the growth, but we left a lot of these trees. Trees are important. These are going to fall in the future, and they're going to, you know, provide habitat, and they will seed the floodplains, which we lower, which are pretty naked, as you saw yesterday. This is a side channel, and I think I missed that point. Our program in the original emphasis was only said 3 side channels would be built, and these are inherently great. I've got a little more data on that future, but they maximize wetted surface for the amount of excavation. You can do a lot for building fish habitat right away by building side channels. This is the side channel at Reading Creek. And this is just to carry you through. This over here we looked at yesterday. This is the force meander at R5. And this is before, basically they brought it down pretty low, but then they dig in, just to show you how we do it. We do the digging entirely off of the river, so it's off channel, and then we're pumping all this material up onto the floodplain and infiltrating the dirty water there. And then we place all the wood, and one of the things we're really doing now is we're placing these clumps of live willows. So rather than placing individual cuttings, these clumps they grow much quicker. They provide immediate habitat and cover for fish when we do open them. Well, after they start growing a little better, that first year they don't do so well. But this spring they'll be coming out. So this is now open, and it's open. You saw this yesterday. It's racking wood. Whoops, right here, and it's racking a bunch of wood, and the water's flowing through that meander. And then this is the final downstream end, which we didn't get out to. And you can see there's a high flow channel through there that will provide great habitat at intermediate flows. And then this is just to remind you of what it looked like before the project. So I'm excited to see, we run these aerial photos about every year. And that is a real resource we could provide to your agency, on the Trinity. That we use, it's invaluable to just be able to look at, and one picture tells a thousand words. So quickly onto the monitoring, which is really where we are. We are this year going to be getting a bunch more reports in, but monitoring, we're looking at fish, at turbidity, at frogs and turtles. So what happens? You guys are dirt oriented, at least from my interpretation. So here's the sawmill channel, or the sawmill rehab site, and we control, and I've told Dean so many times, when it rains or during the construction season, we're good. Like, we don't get river dirt during construction. And now we have a 20 NTU background. And the river, the Trinity River, runs clear. It's 0 to 1. It's clear. You can't tell the difference between the Trinity and tap water. So 20% above background is impossible. So we have a 20 NTU compliance requirement now that works for us. But what happens at high flow? And so this area, we reduced the floodplain to about 6,000 CFS. And then we're going to run over that with a bunch of water. So what happens is you'll see this line. These are some probes that were deployed at different distances down from the sawmill site. This is the flow. You see each time when the flow comes up, there's a spurt of sediment comes off, and then it goes down. And then we come up, and the turbidity goes down. What's the time period? This is May 1st. And it's back, so a week of pretty strong dirt that comes off of the sites, and that's for the benefit. So there is a short-term impact for long-term gain. Fish monitoring. Generally, we're seeing increased health of the fish. small and measured as basically the condition factor, how fat are these fish. Chinook and steelhead have shown generally an increase in the amount of wild fish. But you know, the data that we've been collecting in the field, and I have to thank my colleagues at the Hoopa Valley Tribe, Yurok Tribe, and Fish and Wildlife Service, and those groups in terms of some of the rearing habitat, which I said earlier has been the objective of the restoration program. We found some good data there that I'll give you a little update on, and we've also created quite a bit of spawning. So the juvenile rearing habitat. You know, basically, this information is showing the objective of the restoration program has been to create rearing habitat system-wide and at our rehab site. So I'm looking specifically at the Sven Olversen rehab site done in 2008. And you'll see this is the pre-project condition. It really wasn't inundated too much. The red color, basically the habitat, good habitat is defined as the right depth, velocity, basically slow. Like when we talk about fry, the fry are 50 millimeters or less, 2 inches or less, so very small fish. And then pre-smolt are 8 inches or less. And they both like slow velocities and shallow, and that basically the pre-smolt like it a little deeper and a little faster. And then the red are the pre-site conditions. Well, the red shows quality habitat in terms of slow, shallow velocity habitats. And then the blue is the optimal, and that means that there's cover. So that they're cover in terms of vegetation cover or large wood primarily. And then the green, there's a couple little blips of green, is just where there's cover. So these are the pre and post conditions, and there's a lot more post habitat or post construction. This just goes to show that again. In this slide, we're looking at, you know, overall we see an increase in fry and pre-smolt habitat, 67% for the pre-smolt and 67 for the fry and 57 for the pre-smolt increases in habitat. But for the side channels, and this is showing the side channel increases in habitat, this for fry and pre-smolt. So this is 192% increase in fry habitat with that construction of the Sven Olversen channel. And that's a over 200% increase in habitat for juvenile fish in with the Sven Olversen construction. And you know that the juvenile rearing fish were in there pretty much as soon as that was open to flows. And this just shows the evolution over time. Lower Indian Creek was constructed in 07, and then these were constructed in 08, all of these. But it shows that all side channels are not equal, and I happened to pick the Sven one, which was the best. If you just look at the fry habitat, this density meter squared per meter, it's kind of a normalized value so that you can compare between different sites. And basically, 10.5 at our Sven Olversen site compared to 1.8 for fry is showing that we're doing a lot better job at this site. And why? You know, so then we say, why and can we enhance the Indian Creek site? So all side channels are not the same, but we've got some good ideas on how to increase them. And that gets into this right here. You see the habitat area per treatment area, and Dark Gulch we did real well. Sven Olversen we did well. But these guys, we didn't do quite so well. And this gets into one thing that is covered in our permit with the Water Board. Basically, we're looking at phase two sites primarily, but also in the permit we talk about the potential to go back to our previous sites. And these sites, where is it going to be most cost effective to do work? Maybe at these sites. Hocker Flat, because we think we're a lot better. Hocker Flat and Lower Indian Creek, to make that side channel, you know, as good as the newest ones. So how about How about habitat for adults? You know, adults are what you see on the river. This is kind of a cool shot because this is an aerial photo of the Dark Gulch side channel before, and you can see we've just mapped the reds from 2009 on here before we built the channel. So that gives you an idea of these side channels, and you guys are one of your beneficial uses is spawning habitat. So basically we built the side channel, and you'll see the red dots are 2010 and the yellow dots are 2009 over here. So the fish are immediately using that side channel. And just the same thing, this is Sven Olbersen before construction. This is after construction, so you see all the flow through habitat through here. And this may be the reason it's so high of smolt and fry habitat per meter square per meter is because we actually have three openings. So we're getting three side channels per length of the river. And that's how they're normalized, by dividing through by the length of the river channel. So we got a lot of openings. It's more wetted edge. So how is Sven Olbersen used? This thing, we opened that side channel and or opened the mouth of this, and we had spawning in here like the day after. As the trucks were leaving, we had spawning going on in that side channel. It was pretty darn cool. So the last thing that we emphasize in the record of decision, the points there, was measures to minimize and mitigate impacts. And these are some ones that are coming clear to me as we're working on it. You know, the program has been a bit fish-centered. Trinity River fishery, main stem fishery restoration EIS. And we need to embrace all the species and the geomorphic processes and such. So now we're working on, and we find that these things are really correlated in other systems, wetland construction, you know, the amount of production that may be associated with the river really can help production. So, and then vegetation, we're revegetating areas, revegetating the uplands, and then we're sharing the techniques. On our website, trrp.net, we have quite we're putting more documents up, and it will help others in doing important restoration. So that gets into this reporting feature. And then so here's just an example of the wetlands. And this one is particularly interesting because, you know, I said we're gravel processing at the sites. And then when we put that water, we often put it in a hole that gets buried. And this year we said, hey, don't bury that. You know, don't refill that hole. Let's make that a wetland. And right now, that's it. And we pulled in the side. This is the sides of it, tried to make it real irregular, threw in debris and large wood, organic material. We planted it with some vegetation from the site, and there it is. And then this is the most artificial wetland that we tried. This is a liner wetland, and there it is too. And those are some of the innovative things we're doing. So this year, I'll finish up with this. This is our view for what we're doing, constructing the Wheel Gulch project. That's our first phase two project, and we've got an application in with the water board, and we're trying to figure out exactly how to use. We figured it seems to be in the scope of the master, but we're learning the details on how to do a phase two site with that one. We're going to be funding projects in the watershed. We're putting 5,000 cubic yards of gravel into the river, or up to 5,000 cubic yards with this high flow. That's 7,500. Tons, as I mentioned earlier. We're working on flow scheduling. We think we're going to go to 11,000 this year. And it's not an extremely wet year, but we need to mobilize the material on the sites that we've constructed recently. And then ongoing, we have ongoing science, and our annual report is going to be beefed up, and we're going to have a lot more reports by the end of next year. That's it.
Okay. Two questions. One is, I have heard just different folks from downriver growl that some of the water releases are messing the sturgeon up, and so I was wondering if there's been any monitoring, or you folks, I would say, done any monitoring regarding the sturgeon spawning and stuff like that.
Well,
they come up way early in comparison to salmon. Yeah. My understanding, I'm not a fisheries biologist, but they're downriver, they say that the high flows are messing up the sturgeon.
Our high flows. Well, our high flows emulate the spring snow melt, so right. It's certainly no. It's much lower than many years prior to the dam, so we're just, it's a minor thing. I bet the sturgeon can deal with that.
Yeah, I was just wondering.
But, you know, there may be some studies that would shed some light on that we're not particularly involved with, but Ernie works for the Fish and Wildlife Service, and they are looking at sturgeon. Do you answer that?
You know, I
haven't
checked
that. It's not addressed in our program. Somebody were concerned they could seek funding from us.
Yeah.
This kind of
like,
I mean, just because I think it might be addressed by some of our program
where
they
do sturgeon on the
ground.
I have heard the results of their life. Yeah, I would be interested in knowing that. I just can remember when I was a little girl watching sturgeon swim under the Sawyer Bridge.
And under what bridge?
The Sawyer Bridge.
Uh-huh.
We would stand in my dad's.
Sawyer Bridge.
Yeah, we Sawyer.
If I didn't Sawyer.
Sawyer. Sawyer. Everyone wants to say Sawyer or Sawyer.
I got that. Sawyer.
But we would stand there and watch him, and sturgeon haven't seen sturgeon.
Yeah.
But anyhow, that. And then my other question was regarding the mine tailings. Do any of those historical mine tailing sites fall into any of the ARC rules, or can they just be gone?
That's
just
an excellent
question.
We're everywhere we go and do work, we have a programmatic agreement between the agencies that are doing the work, and Reclamation does surveys and determines whether the sites are eligible for the National Register of Historic Places. That said, there's been, you know, we live in the state of Jefferson up here, and everyone, I mean, Siskiyou County and the Southern Oregon and Trinity, they have this uniform thing that they really have this family history. And, you know, I've been living on this land, I heard it from Heidi earlier on. And so we are working with our archaeologists to come up with a plan that, you know, basically, and the locals have been asking about this, is it may not be eligible for the National Register. It's a bit gray, you know, to be honest. The National
Yeah, because it's definitely a visual part of our county's history.
Yeah.
I played on, we had tons of mine tailings on our property. I grew up right on the river, and so it was always, you know, we always knew what those were, you know,
right.
And how they got there. And I've heard different people say about the project, you know.
We're taking them out.
Can they just tear those mine tailings up, you know? Because they value them, you know, from a historical perspective. And, anyway.
And it's interesting, but, you know, I guess the shorter version of that is that, you know, we do take out a lot of mine tailings, and we will take out a lot more, but there will be some areas that we won't, and we're planning to put up some interpretive signing, and then there's also some areas that won't be eligible for the National Register, but there'll be some, you know, actually the whole point about documentation, there's already been developed a historic context for our Trinity River, and, you know, that, I don't think that's on the website. I need to get that on our website. And what we're talking about now is doing a more comprehensive version of that basically includes a map so that it gives our archaeologists a better ability to jump out and really do the surveys quickly, because it refers to the Union Hill Ditch or this mining operation. So documentation, if nothing else, will be pretty enhanced by that.
I have one more question, and it's just for fun. Since you're working in the river, putting the gravels back in and stuff, do you have a new appreciation for what the days of old, what the people had to go through when they were mining? And I'm just always impressed that the magnitude of earth that was moved with less technology than what we have now. I mean, I don't know if we make people like that anymore that can endure that level of labor.
At Limekiln Gulch, which is one of our new sites, it's planned. There's a spoiling area. You know, basically we can't change the flood elevation of the river when we do our construction. Or we can't increase the base flood elevation. So the place that we needed to spoil was this flat area up pretty high. And we went up there, and you know, next thing you know, it's mining heaven. And I climb up, and I'm hooked in to the Union Hill Ditch, which goes, you know, that is the one, the steel bridge abutments on the Trinity goes to the Union Hill. And then next thing I know, I start receiving photos, and it has 100 guys digging in that ditch. And, you know, there's a reason why we need to document. And so our project isn't exactly there, but it's tied into that. And that's why this whole thing about getting a little bit better historical documentation, it's really caught me. So I have a big appreciation for the work that went out there.
I have a statistic on that from a previous presentation that was the dredger tailings, mm-hmm. that they were mining that way, they moved more material in 6 months than we'll move in 10 years of the restoration work that they're doing, just to put it in perspective. Wow. They move a lot of material up and down the river, and we're sort of trying to fine tune what they did and turn it back into fish habitat. So it was a huge part of the legacy of the river.
Yeah. The big dredgers moved over 100,000 cubic yards, and I think that's way off. I just saw it in one of these historical documents. Yeah, in a month. So, and we're, our projects are typically, you know, 100,000 cubic yards is a big project. So those guys are doing that in a month.
We're now, what, 11 years after the ROD, and we're... All of it's aimed at getting us more of those. How are we doing?
Well, the jury's out. You know, the fish have been going up and down, and you know, some of the metrics are indicating that there's more natural, you know, percentages of natural, because one of the things that they, you know, the natural fish, the natural spawning fish do, they live in the river from December to June, you know, when they release the hatchery fish, and that, you know, so that by seeing increasing percentage of those, we think that we're moving the right way. But, you know, in order to see the 3-year lived fish, typically 3 to 5 year, and so we need to be looking at that and really monitoring. But that's why the record of decision was so adamant about moving forward at a fast pace, because these fish are short lived, and, you know, we can make a tremendous impact in a short time.
I think it's undeniable with the amount of habitat area that has been created and is going to be created compared to what is being programmed. So regardless, if you're not seeing the numbers back, the suitable areas for them to be able to respond are increasing by leaps and bounds.
Right. And unfortunately, as we're all aware, there's hatcheries and hydrographs, and you know, there's habitat, and anyway, there's a number of things in harvest. You know, those are the four H's that the fish guys talk about typically, and those all can potentially impact, you know, ocean conditions. So we could do everything right and still not have the fish, but hopefully that won't be the case. We'll have a nice river that will have the geomorphic processes, the river processes, and the habitat, so when they come back, go ahead.
What I want to ask you, have you done any studies on coho smell? I'm a small...
a late day. Late day afternoon. I just said that because out of Scott and Shasta, people were pretty shocked when they put telemetry studies on them, that they're racing, probably because of lack of water and heat, but anyway, they're racing to the mouth of the Tiny River, and there's a very few creeks there that sort of, you know, tremendous heavy lifting for the coho. I wonder whether you're observing the same phenomenon, or whether anyone studied that out of the Trinity.
Yes, we do fund the Iraq tribe who's doing a coho study. They were already doing it for the time, so it's probably what you're saying.
Yeah.
They expanded it this year to include Trinity, so they put tags in the fish and have radio telemetry at the tributary. So they know when they come up this tributary when they leave, and that's exactly what we're finding is they race around the river and use different habitats. So it's both this gulch for a while, and then come down and go there up its stem. It's really interesting in high rock body habitat. You kind of need to know how the fish behave in the river. And it's been pretty remarkable to find out how the fish behaves, and how it's been very popular in the river. So
good. One other question. What is the length of time you think when modifications you make to the channel will last versus natural forces that are in the world? I mean, do you think 10 years from now we'll be able to see that? 20 years from now, do you think the river's going to be fighting with you?
That's a great question, because you know, that it kind of gets into the habitat versus the process question that we wrestle with. You know, the record of decision and our objective is to make habitat that will, and process that will be self-maintaining, that the river will carry on. But there's a real strong correlation between wetted surface area and numbers of juvenile fish, and that's what you see in the side channel data. So are the side channels the answer? How will those evolve over time with high flows? And so right now that's one that we're working on. How, you know, where should we build habitat? You know, you have higher flows down the river, so you would think that maybe the things that we build will be more self-maintaining downstream. But we're working on that question right now, and yeah, there's no straightforward answer.
One last question. You have very clearly mapped out by geography where you're getting better results versus worse results. But you use a lot of different techniques in different areas. What technique do you think is sort of the best and what do you think is sort of the worst?
You know, a lot of that is based, and we're doing some...
Or do you think you don't know enough because the sites may be dominating?
Well, I think that we're moving in the right way. What we've done is, you know, there's been a lot of looking and habitat monitoring. We're just getting back some of the information on our juvenile fish. But what we've used is a bunch of information recently from other places where salmon do well, up in Washington specifically. And they're bringing down a bunch of information on large wood installations, engineered log jams, some real valuable definitions and techniques, side channel construction that work to get fish. And then you have this balance that we want the process and the fish. So we're using some, in the interim, while we're collecting our own information, we're doing what works in other places.
I'd like to add to that. Yeah. There's something unique going on in the program right now. So that's a great question. What is the bill that works and what didn't? That's what we made a big point to say. We're finished with phase one. We're entering into the phase two planning process. We actually are doing less construction work this year than we had originally planned purposefully. So we're really calling this the year we're going to reject and learn. And just in case it reaches the board level, we are starting to receive a couple of letters this week in demand with people saying, you know, we really want you to approve to us that what you're doing is the right work before you start phase two. So, hearing from stakeholders in the public, maybe a 2-year pause might be more appropriate. We're going to work through that for the legal stakeholders. So we're really taking this period to document what really was working well, what into the future through a public stakeholder process, which we have in place. I just wanted to mention that. But, we intend to have the position answer that question before we launch into phase two of the river.
And then just the one in what happens when I drive 299 and always with fisheries people and they're debating the pros and cons of every single one of your projects.
I recognize that project.
And so this project, we had the tree that came out and there was a hope of broadening the river channel, the car talk. I realize that's a little unscientific because they thought that one did not work as well as some of the others. And I wondered how that fit into your geographic.
But that one is the how fit in it's at, you know, it's at the bend up here, the Bitsum Bend, and I call those the boat slips.
Yeah.
And they're great for parking your boat. And the idea was that let the river do the work, is, you know, what the original record of decision said. The location that was chosen for that, I think maybe we should have put a side channel there. I'm an advocate of side channels, but it's on the inside of a curve, and you know there's not as much scour. That, you know, the outside of the curve is where you typically find scour and erosion, and so those there's less habitat than when we first created them.
Well, with that, I wanted to, you know, maybe this whole thing is a Star Trek project, and that we're going to no man's gone before, because it strikes me that, you know, in the, from the Trinity perspective, you know, it's got so many differences from so many of the other systems that at least I'm aware of or recognize. You know, you've got a dam that gives you really high quality cold water seasonally that you can kind of play with, at least based on your reindeer, and you've got a gravel input that you can play with, that you can modify. You've got 40 miles of channel to, you know, as your palate, and yet I was here about 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, and you know, you clicked off another couple of projects, and I think it's really, really interesting. I think it's interesting just as the intentional manipulation of a kind of controlled and infinitely variable system there. And I have to say, you know, that your project and your program, you know, collectively is just fascinating to me. And going out there yesterday, boots on the ground, you know, it's really a neat opportunity for me. And I got to say, your enthusiasm is infectious. You know, it kind of opens up some of the possibilities on the restoration side about, you know, and then you can test the hypothesis here as well, too, in your outcomes and the iterative in your process. So thanks for getting us out there yesterday. Even in the rain, it was great. And
thanks for coming.
That was really cool. I also wanted to take a minute, though, to recognize our staff, Dean. I know you worked on this a lot. I think others have too. I want to actually compliment Samantha. I listened in fascination yesterday, the discussion of why this CEQA process and the master kind of CEQA document that got put out there was important. I have done CEQA work, and I've done work under CEQA requirements and all that kind of thing, and I compliment our staff. So I think, you know, you've got a very sharp little mind that goes 3 steps ahead on the theory part, strategy and tactics, and it sounds to me like this is a really good thing. So, fantastic job, and Dean and others, I'm sure that I don't know here, but I think we all shine on each other here, and so I think it's a really good thing.
I've been the burr on their side. These guys are busy, and I know it. And you know, you all know the state budget, and Dean and Samantha have been the reason we got this EIR done. And this year we called back, and I didn't give them as much heads up as I should have, and they've been really helpful. So I thank them.
I'm not sure the board knows this, but when the original ROD came out, Trinity County did the goal of the CEQA document, but never certified it. And so the state was left without a CEQA document for any of the various permits. And so what we went in and did was just didn't pull it and did the programmatic. So now all state agencies, including us, came out revising this document. That's what, and now it's starting to pay off.
That's why there were 4 EIRs in that first year, because the Fed was sued and finalized or won in court in 2004. And after that, the thought was, Jim Moose, Mr. CEQA, said, they're going to go after you under CEQA if they're going to do anything. So you better be solid. And that's why we had those EIRs. And now we have a master EIR, which I think is solid.
And in all fairness, they had some significant pains that were really not interested in seeing the
But, you know, it kind of comes back to the, what we heard this morning on Timber. You know, I mean, I think as agencies, as individuals, as programs, and people out there on the ground, I think we have to find efficiencies where efficiencies can be had. And whether that be on the regulatory side, on the document side, the EIR, or whatever, on, you know, using your gravel, like, you know, you've got all these mine tailings around, kind of, you know, there are opportunities out there. And I just think that this is a fascinating process here. And maybe it shines some light on the way forward on some of this stuff.
Well, and that's actually why I took this job. Now, my training is fisheries, and I've been measuring the demise of endangered fish in Utah and Oregon and California, and it's sad, you know, that we need to do something, and restoration is where it's at. And, you know, these are short-lived fish. I've worked with long-lived fish a lot, and the short-lived fish, you don't have as much time. So we need to streamline this and really help so that the water board has been extremely helpful, and I've learned a lot, and we need to share how to do that and do it in other systems, because the natural, you know, there's more people. There's a real strong correlation between, or an inverse correlation between numbers of people in a watershed the numbers of fish. That's one of the reasons we can do it on the Trinity. There's not a lot of people here. But we need to be able to do it more with our people and get regulatory streamlining. Thank you.
And thanks, Dean.
Yeah, thank you, Dean.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you, George.
Yeah, thanks.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Jennifer.
Yeah, you're welcome.
All right.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah. Mr. Lancaster.
Here we go.